Hello and welcome to Crosstalk, where all things are considered. I'm Peter Lavelle. Has the so-called American century come to an end? If so, how did it come about? Was it poor leadership or the mission to lead the world itself was always destined to fail? And what follows the end of the American century? Crosstalking the end of the American century, I'm joined by my guest, Peter Kuznick in Bethesda. He's a professor of history and director of the Nuclear Studies Institute at American University, as well as co-author with Oliver Stone of The Untold History of the United States. In Istanbul, we have Pepe Escobar. He's an independent geopolitical analyst and author specializing in Eurasia. And in Cali, we cross to Ajamu Baraka. He is a national organizer for the Black Alliance for Peace. All right, gentlemen, crosstalk rules in effect. That means you can jump anytime you want, and I always appreciate it. Pepe, let me go to you. I mean, this program is kind of based on this article by David Pressner in Harper's Magazine, and it was the title of the article was Empire Burlesque. And it kind of sent a lot of shockwaves. A lot of people were really kind of surprised by it, but I don't think anybody on this panel would be surprised by it whatsoever. And I found it really quite amusing that this was such a bold article, and a critique of the elites and all that. I thought it was a good chronology. But he didn't say anything that was particularly interesting or new. Go ahead, Pepe.
No, it's a mediocre essay. Mediocre essay for mediocre readers in America. You know, the best writers across Eurasia, Russians, Chinese, Iranians, Pakistanis, Indians, across Latin America, the best Brazilians, Argentinians, Uruguayans, across Africa. Well, they have been writing about this in detail for over 10 years now, if not since the mid-2000s at the height of the war on terror. Basically, we all know that the free lunch that lasted for 75 years is over. So we are now discussing what's going to happen next, of course. And you just need to take a look at what's happening at the SCO summit in September in Samarkand, what happened at the BRICS summit in Beijing a few weeks ago, what happened at the Tehran tripartite summit, Erdogan, Raisi, and Putin in Tehran this week. This is where we're going. The interaction of all these institutions across Eurasia towards what the Russians themselves have called Greater Eurasia Partnership, but it's bigger than Eurasia. It's Eurafrica Asia as well. Let's bring Africa into it, and let's bring Latin America it is a new world.
Absolutely, I agree with you, Peter. If I could read a quick fragment from the article here, are we doomed to witness the return of great power rivalry in which the United States and China vie for influence, or will the decline of the U.S. produce novel forms of international collaboration? But kind of dovetailing on what Pepe has to say, is this even an important question anymore? I mean, because really the way this article is written about American elites, should we lament the end of the American century or not? I mean, I don't even think that's a question anymore. And I think this is what this mindset is all about. The world is moving on, and the U.S. has to find its place in it. That's probably a better way of putting it. Go ahead, Peter.
Biden came to power saying that he was going to restore American hegemony after the Trump years, and he was going to unite the Europeans behind the Americans. The United States is going to provide leadership to the world. And we see how well that's worked out. Situation internationally has only gotten worse in the past 2 years. And the reason why we can't allow this kind of bifurcation, this kind of division, is because we're facing existential crises. We're dealing with the climate is the most obvious one now. As Europe is burning, as the runways are melting in London, the heat wave, people are dying, and it's only going to get worse, only going to get much, much worse. And we're facing an existential crisis because of the nuclear threat. The West is committed, the Europeans and the United States are committed to defeating Russia, even though they themselves say, many of the leaders understand, that if they succeeded and made Putin desperate, then Russia would likely resort to nuclear weapons, which would again potentially precipitate the end of life on the planet. So we're not in a position where we have the luxury to sit back and allow the two sides with their insular views and backward notions to destroy our planet. So we're facing a serious crisis right now. American hegemony has already ended. Even Charles Krauthammer in 1990, Krauthammer announced this is America's unipolar moment.
Right.
In 2002, he says, I was wrong. This is a unipolar era. It's not going to last 30 or 40 years like I thought. It's going to last indefinitely. But by 2006, even Krauthammer, after the debacles in Iraq and Afghanistan, even Krauthammer had to admit that the unipolar moment and the unipolar era were a fantasy. So we've known this. Oliver Stone and I wrote about this extensively in Untold History. And my other colleagues on the show have been writing about this and talking about it for years. The question is, how do we prevent this from turning into the crisis that ends life on our planet?
Ajamu, I think it's really interesting, noting what Peter and Pepe have already said here, is that can the world survive America reckoning that it is no longer the hegemon? I mean, this is what it really gets down to, because it's so incestuous, the political elites in the United States, and it is so narrow, the definition of how they see their place in the world. It's either all or there'll be chaos. Again, this article is very light-headed in the way I look at it, is because it doesn't look at the realities playing out on the ground. And as Pepe said here, the world is moving on, and the U.S. has to find its place in it. And that's something that Americans can't contemplate because of American exceptionalism, which we'll talk about later. Go ahead, Incali.
Well, you know, Peter, you're absolutely right. And the other commentaries are spot on the money. But basically, what we have is that the U.S. elites are unable to accept the new political realities. They seem to be committed to their notion of full spectrum dominance, no matter what the conditions are. And it seems that they are prepared to basically blow up the world in order to maintain the dominance of the European project. And that's why we say today that this represents the existential threat to collective global humanity, that this pathological commitment on the part of the white West, if you will, to maintain global hegemony, is putting all of us at threat. And that basically, unless and until we're able to shift power from the US, EU, NATO project, all of us are facing the possibility of a global catastrophe.
Well, Pepe, I mean, what is driving this here? I mean, from the West, is it ideological for you? Is it just economic hegemony? Because I tend to fall back on the sense of American exceptionalism, that the American elites, and he talks about here liberal interventionists versus restrainers, which I think is a joke, because both camps, if you want to say, they believe in American exceptionalism, and that is the great barrier, to accept the fact that we aren't preordained to run the world. That is something that is part of the American DNA. How do they deal with it, Pepe?
Well, in continental Europe, it's still the primacy of the ideas of the Enlightenment. This is something that we see, especially in France and in Germany.
Yeah, but don't you think, Pepe, don't you think I think they're actually in defiance of their own ideals, you know, sanctity of property,
yeah,
due process, freedom of speech.
Absolutely.
No, it's all rubbish, okay? I don't think that
they don't see it.
The Enlightenment. Go ahead, Pepe.
Yeah, but they don't see it, Peter.
Yeah.
It's amazing. I live between East and West, as a lot of people know. I just came back from NATO stand in France for almost 3 months, and I arrive in Istanbul, and I feel relieved. I can have an intellectual dialogue in Istanbul, which I tried many times to have in Paris, and it's absolutely impossible. And these people, they know their Enlightenment by heart, but they simply don't see it, how their own ideals are melting nowadays. In the UK, it's different. In the UK, it's still a little bit of white man's burden left. And of course, in America, is in every silo of intelligence, or so-called intelligence in the US, is about American exceptionalism. It's an extremely America-centric view of the world, and we don't need to go back to Lévi-Strauss to once again state that Americans, as a rule of thumb, simply cannot understand the other. And the problem is the other, which is basically the global South, which is 88% of the world's population. Now, they are finding an alternative model or alternative converging models. And they are trying to build literally a new system of international relations. From the point of view of, from an hegemonic point of view, either continental Europe, UK or America, and the collective West as a whole, this is beyond anathema. This is the ultimate red line. But this is something that they thought would never happen. Yeah, end of history. Now,
but Peter, this mindset, when I call it American exceptionalism, but I mean, and it's Eurocentric as well, and it's untenable. I mean, it's really amazing. You know, you look at Europe right now because of what's going on in Ukraine. They have an energy crisis, possible food crisis. There are food banks here, and they still hold these ideas that they're the center of the world. Go ahead, Peter.
Well, in some ways, they are still very, very relevant and very important. You know, we can't discount the West when we're looking at the future of humanity at this point. The problem is that they're so short-sighted. Take the case of Biden. Okay, Biden wants to weaken Russia. He wants to punish Russia. And in order to do so, he is effectively creating conditions in the U.S. and in much of the rest of the world that are going, especially in the U.S. now, the big issue on people's mind is inflation, the cost of living, gas, housing, all these real concerns. And what Biden's policies are doing now in order to punish Russia is exacerbating that, making it worse, creating more suffering. His approval ratings are in the low to mid 30s right now. And what he's effectively doing is saying he's willing to allow Donald Trump, the Republicans, the fascists, the climate deniers.
Peter, let me jump in here. I have to go to a hard break, and after that hard break, we'll continue our discussion on the end of the American century. Stay with RT. Welcome back to Crosstalk, where all things are considered. I'm Peter LaBelle. To remind you, we're discussing the end of the American century. Okay, let's go back to Peter in Bethesda. I'm sorry I had to cut you off, but we had to go to a hard break. Go ahead, finish your thought, Peter.
Let me quote Friedrich Nietzsche. He said, "In individuals, insanity is rare, but in groups, parties, nations, and epochs, it is the rule." Up to this point, at least until 77 years ago, with the atomic bombs of Hiroshima and Nagasaki, we did not have the power to end life on the planet the way we do now. So you see in the United States, democracy is very, very fragile right now. You've got one party committed to destroying American democracy, the little bit democracy that still remains in the United States. And Biden, in his efforts to weaken, punish Russia, is bringing about the further destruction of American democracy, bringing the Trumpists back into power. It makes no rational sense. And what we're seeing on a global scale right now also makes no rational sense. So, I mean, I think we're at a crucial turning point, because the United States, while it might not have the moral authority and might not have the economic power that it once did, still has the power to bring the world down. And so that's what makes it so dangerous. And others recognize that. The meeting in Anchorage between Blinken and Sullivan and the two top Chinese foreign policy officials back in March of last year, when Wang Yi says to Sullivan, he says, "You don't have the authority to talk to us like this anymore. You can't talk to us from a position of strength." Well, that's true, but there is nobody providing international leadership. Pepe is more optimistic when he looks at the global South than I am right now, because I see a struggle that is much more dangerous and much more unresolved. Though I see some positive developments, I also see negative ones. I see Yoon winning in South Korea. I see Japan moving sharply to the right. I see a lot of very dangerous trends as well as some positive ones.
Okay, let's go back to Cali here. One of the things that I've observed here on how the global South has reacted to the situation in Ukraine, and I think it's important to state here, is that the global South no longer, first of all, doesn't respect the West anymore because of its hypocrisy, but it doesn't fear it as much either. And that is a significant paradigm shift right now, because we see the global South is basically saying, you know, we don't want to get involved in a conflict that you generated. Now, we can talk about the origins all we want, but they're saying it's not our fight. And why should, and then when the idea of sovereignty, you have to protect Ukraine's sovereignty, but the global South is saying we're going to protect our sovereignty too by not getting involved in your fight. And I think this is a paradigm shift. They're no longer respect or fear the West. Go ahead, Nkali.
But you know, Peter, you're right. But I think that what we see in the global South too is an understanding that in fact power is shifting to the non-European world, if you will. And so there's always been an understanding of the potential power here in the global South. We understood the parasitic relationship between the development of the North and the underdevelopment of the South. But now the conditions are such that basically there's the possibility of more effective resistance. And so what we see in the global South are the experiments taking place of the reconstruction of societies along new paths of development, new lines of values. And that is something that I think is very, very positive. You know, one of the things that we have to understand is that and what makes the North so incredibly dangerous is this inflated sense of itself. Mm-hmm. It's a belief that without its leadership, global leadership, that the world can no longer exist as we know it. This goes back to your point about U.S. exceptionalism. You have European exceptionalism. The psychopathology of white supremacist ideology has to be addressed front and center. The Europeans have to understand that they are no longer the center of the world. And again, when they understand that and when we're able to make that reflect a material reality that is shifting power from the Europeans, then we have the possibility of developing and constructing a new world.
Okay, Pepe, in this article here by this David Bressner, essentially he's asking, what is the world like after the American century? Is it a good thing? Should we be afraid? Because I think you're right. Peter's a little bit more pessimistic. You're a little bit more optimistic. Where does it go from here? Because the global system ever since 1945 has been centered on the West, specifically the United States. That is slowly drifting away. Is that a good thing, a bad thing, a dangerous thing? Go ahead, Pepe.
Well, if I was really a passive nihilist, not an active nihilist as Nietzsche, I would give up completely and isolate myself on a volcanic island somewhere. You know? But I still keep, I'm a writer, and writers, as you all know, they die writing. So I will die writing and at least trying to find a ray of light into this maelstrom, Edgar Allan Poe's maelstrom, in fact. And that's why these past few years I have been focusing on what's happening across Eurasia, the development, slowly but surely, of all these organizations, the Shanghai Cooperation Organization, the Eurasia Economic Union, now BRICS Plus, which is something that the Chinese and the Russians have been pushing for quite a while now, the CSTO, all the projects of the New Silk Roads and merging with the Russian concept of Greater Eurasian Partnership, and how all these organizations and this framework across Eurasia is spilling over towards Africa, Latin America,
yeah, but Pepe, to be fair here, you know, this is one of the origins of the crisis in Ukraine, because, you know, Ukraine has to be part of the West because you have to separate it from Russia to weaken Russia. The reason why I'm bringing this up, I'll go to Peter right now, is that I agree with what Pepe's been talking about, all these organizations, but the U.S. is not very happy about it because it wants to maintain its agenda. hegemony, and that's what makes it a very dangerous country. Go ahead, Peter.
Yeah, that's no question about that. Yeah.
You know, we see some interesting trends and some hopeful trends. Latin America, a lot of progressives are winning elections now, and Lula hopefully will come back to power in Brazil. There's some good things happening. But then we also see this AUKUS deal. India is a very important player. It's the biggest, it's the second biggest country in the world, and will soon be the largest country in the world, and is trying to, like many countries, people don't want to choose sides. The U.S. is trying to force countries to choose sides again, and people are resisting. And that's the positive part of the positive trend that Pepe's correctly identifying. But we have such big problems that we need to somehow figure out a way for the U.S. and the Europeans to get back in the game in a positive sense. Because even if we look about global warming, if one of the consequences of what this war, the Russian invasion of Ukraine, is setting back the need for dealing aggressively with global warming, is setting this back potentially for years.
But Peter, you try to convince me that these people actually believe this about climate change. I mean, if it is so existential, so dire, and they flip on a dime, no, we have to go after Russia first. I mean, are they sincere people, or are they just buffoons?
Well, they're not buffoons. That's part of the problem. They can be dangerous, you know, because of their ideology, because of the way they view the world. And this goes back to the start of the Cold War. You know, the most important document for me is a memo that George Kennan wrote in 1948, when he says the U.S. has 6.3% of the world's population, but controls 50% of the world's wealth. You know, how are we going to maintain this position of disparity? We live in a world now where the richest 8 people have more wealth than the poorest 4 billion people. More and more people are falling into poverty, you know, and so we have serious crises.
Yeah, but that's what neoliberalism is created for all of us, okay? Let's go back to Cali, because what I think is really interesting is that with the rise of the global south, it doesn't seem to be very ideological to me. It means I look at, you know, sovereignty, prosperity. I mean, those are simple ideas to understand, and not all this garbage that's coming out of the West, rules-based order, whatever that means, okay? I mean, I think what we need is more pragmatism and less ideology. Go ahead, and Callie.
Well, you know, we need that. And we also need to always include in the picture the parasitic relationship. The non-exploitation is what's driving much of the politics here in the global south. Also, that they understand that we can no longer continue in a relationship of a dependency with the global north, with the global capitalist system that is dependent on the continuation of the oppression and exploitation of people around the world. So that's why people don't want to be pulled into this conflict in Europe. Even though they are being detrimentally impacted by this conflict, that's also why the U.S. is unable, U.S. and Europe, is unable to bring people along politically and ideologically in the global south. Because people in the global south remember that while Zelensky and Ukraine are attempting to try to renegotiate their debt payments with Europe, we remember that most of the global south nations failed to get any kind of relief from debt payments at the height of the pandemic. So these kinds of relationships are fresh in our minds. Therefore, these moral appeals to join them in their glorious struggle against the Russians fall on deaf ears. We recognize again that until there is until we undermine the prestige of the West, this notion of the West being the leaders of humanity, and that we all should be striving to be a part of that and to see that as a model. Until the West understands, that is, the people of the West understand that they no longer can be the center, then we're going to continue with these appeals to exceptionalism, And for that to resonate.
I guess the big question is, can we survive the period after the American century? We're all going to find out because it's happening right now. Gentlemen, that's all the time we have here. I want to thank my guests in Cali, Bethesda, and in Istanbul. And I want to thank our viewers for watching us here at RT. See you next time. Remember, Crosstalk Rules.